This month, we were tracking the touching story about a grieving orca whale off of Seattle, carrying her dead calf for weeks. She just finally resumed activities with her pod after her loss. Robin Baird, a scientist who has studied small whales and dolphins for the last 20 years, has witnessed that behavior before in the Pacific Northwest. He says there have been reports of similar behavior in pilot whales here in Hawaii. We talked to Baird about the behavior of our majestic marine creatures, his research currently underway, and the efforts to understand and protect threatened and endangered species.
With the false killer whales here in Hawaii, there's an endangered population around the main Hawaiian Islands, and just in the last few weeks, National Marine Fisheries Service implemented a critical habitat rule. And the critical habitat is basically an area that obviously is critically important to the animal's survival. And what critical habitat does is it basically increases the oversight on any sort of federal activities that occur in that area to try to make sure that they're not going to have any major effect on the critical habitat, and if they are, then to basically, you know, make sure, are there any particular conditions should be imposed to mitigate those impacts. The most recent abundance estimate for the main Hawaiian Island insular population is actually about 167 individuals, and that's from a survey that we've been doing in conjunction with various other folks where we're photo-identifying individuals and estimating their abundance from that work. The population back in the 1980s was over 400 individuals, probably in the 400 to 700 range. And we're still at a stage where a lot of what we're trying to do is understand why the population declined and what threats the population is facing. So we're doing things like collecting little blubber biopsy samples to look at pollutant levels. Looking at injuries that the animals have that they might have obtained from interactions with fishing gear. And we think that one of the biggest problems is that false killer whales like to eat the same kind of fish that we like to eat. So they eat mahi and ahi and ono. And so a lot of the times what happens is they'll try to take a fish off a line and end up ingesting a hook or getting entangled in the fishing gear.
Interesting. Now, you've studied them for a long time. What is it that endears these false killer whales to you?
Well, here in Hawaii, I've been working since 1999, and false killer whales have always been my favorite species to work with and our highest priority species to encounter. They're very similar to killer whales in a lot of ways, in the sense that they're long-lived, they have very strong social bonds, and so the groups that we're seeing are individuals that are basically fairly cohesive family units, and it's usually a mother and her offspring. False killer whales are particularly unusual for any species in that they regularly share the prey, but not only do they share what they catch, if one catches a big ahi or a mahi, they'll pass it back and forth. And unlike other species that share prey, usually one whale and other species will take a bite out of a fish and maybe then another whale will pick it up. But these guys, we've actually seen them passing fish back and forth in a fairly ritualistic way. They won't actually eat it. They'll pass the fish to one of their sort of hunting companions, and they'll take it, and it'll pass it to a third one, and then they'll pass it back to the first one, and it's not until then that they start to eat the fish. So it really seems like it's a way to sort of reinforce the social bonds that they have. Of all the species here in Hawaii, they're also probably the one that I think has the most interesting connection with humans, in the sense that they'll actually, this prey-sharing behavior, they'll actually give fish to people in the water. And a couple friends of mine have had that happen, where a false killer whale will come up to them with a big fish and actually offer the fish to them.
Really?
And in both cases, that's happened. The people in the water have given the fish back, and then the whale takes the fish and moves off on its own. But it tells you something about what they think about humans. And, you know, they're not just viewing us as, they're not just indifferent to us. They actually see the connection themselves. You know, obviously humans have a lot of connections with whales and dolphins, but I think sometimes it's one-sided. And this is a case where the whales seem to have some connection with humans as well.
Right, the interaction there. Fascinating.
Yep.
Well, tell me about the connection that you might have, because you see these whales, you track them, you tag them, I think, right? So what's it like when you see one that you've tagged from your early days? I mean, it's like seeing an old friend.
Yeah, and many of these whales have very distinctive markings on the dorsal fin. So even if it's not one that we've tagged in the past, we know a lot about them, and we're learning more all the time just by increasing our field effort off different islands. So, for example, off Lanai'i, there's a social group, a pod, if you want to call them that, that spends most of its time west of Lanai'i, and then there's another social group that's off Kohala primarily. And from my perspective, it's just amazing the insights that we get into their social organization and into their biology. When we get tags on the animals, we're able to track them remotely through the Argos satellite system, and so we're able to get an idea of where they're spending their time. Are they spending their time windward or leeward? And how often they move among the islands? And it's even though it's a relatively small population, we're slowly starting to build up a pretty detailed understanding of their lives around the island. We're actually working off of Kauai right now, and our current project is funded by the U.S. Navy, and we're trying to put tags on different species of whales and dolphins prior to a Navy training exercise, with the idea that we would be able to get information sort of on before, during, and after locations and behavior. And we've been doing this work here for a few years now and have had these types of tags out on pilot whales, bottlenose dolphins, and another resident dolphin over here called the rough-toothed dolphin. And for those three species, the individuals we're tagging so far have all been part of resident populations. And so they're resident to Kauai and Niihau. And we actually haven't seen strong reactions from those three species. And I think in part it's that they've been exposed to Navy sonar here pretty regularly for most of their lives. And to some extent, they've just gotten used to it. On the other hand, there are some species like Blainville's beaked whales and Cuvier's beaked whales that are thought to be much more susceptible to the effects of exposure to sonar. And in those cases, I think the species either just leave the area. In Blainville's beaked whales, that's been documented in the past based on acoustic work that the Navy has done. And other species like Cuvier's beaked whales, even though there's a resident population of Cuvier's off the Big Island, off Kona, we don't see any of that species off the Navy range here. And my suspicion is that they were probably here far in the past, but have just moved, left the area because of the regular use of Navy sonar here. So I think it really varies by species and the exposure that those individuals and those species have had in the past.
So some adapt and some say, I don't like this, I'm going to go somewhere else. This annoys me.
Yeah, absolutely. During our project out here last August, and I wasn't actually on the boat at the time, but the field crew encountered a group that basically was a number of rough-toothed dolphins, which is a fairly common species off Kauai. And there were two other individuals in the group, one that obviously was a melon-headed whale, which is about the same size of a rough-toothed dolphin, and they're actually oceanic dolphins as well. They just happen to be called whales. And then the other individual that was present was had characteristics that were sort of halfway between a melon-headed whale and a rough-toothed dolphin. And the team was able to get a skin biopsy sample from this animal. And from the skin biopsy sample, we were able to confirm with the genetics that it was a hybrid between the two species.
Okay, so not a new species, but a hybrid.
Yes, yeah. And it's the first time that either of those species have been recorded hybridizing with anything in the wild. So it was a pretty unusual finding. And it was also unusual because the animal, melon-headed whales have a very rounded head, and rough-toothed dolphins have this very long, sloping beak or rostrum, and this hybrid was just completely intermediate between the two. So it was definitely something that if anyone got a good photo of or a good look at, you could see that it was definitely something different. When we're out on the water, we're basically looking for any group of whales or dolphins out there, and we approach the group. We get photos of individuals. We have photo ID catalogs of both species here in the islands, and so it's just during that sort of standard operations when we encounter a group of getting photos that the hybrid popped up with the head visible, and then the team basically immediately noticed that it was a different appearing animal, and then proceeded to get the biopsy sample. On our current project, we're working in the same area that the hybrid was documented last year, and we're seeing lots of groups of rough-toothed dolphins. So if the animal stayed in the area, there's a reasonable chance that we may be able to find it. And if we do, one of the things that we're very interested in is the melon-headed whale that the hybrid was traveling with. So we know from the genetics that the mother of the hybrid was a melon-headed whale and the father was a rough-toothed dolphin. Hmm. And so we think that the melon-headed whale that was in that with the hybrid might be its mother. And if we see them again, we'll try to get a little genetic sample to confirm that. One thing that I think is important is the role of citizen science. And a lot of what we know about whales and dolphins here in Hawaii comes from folks that are working on the water or playing on the water that have cameras with them and take photos of animals that, you know, certain individuals that we're able to recognize and add to our catalogs. And a lot of what we know about false killer whales and pilot whales and beach whales and these other species comes from those types of opportunities people have. So I just always want to encourage folks that do have cameras with them. If they have a close encounter, it's just great to get photos and great to contribute those photos that help us learn more about the lives of the different species here in Hawaiian waters.
That was Robin Baird with the Cascadia Research Institute talking about the many things scientists have come across in their studies across the Hawaiian Islands as they track and tag small whales and dolphins.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
One particular neighborhood in Cleveland, Ohio, had it worse than most others during the financial crisis.
We were losing about 2 houses a day to foreclosure, the highest foreclosure rate in the entire United States.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. 10 years later, how rent to own could help bring that neighborhood back. That is next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your quiz. For today's quiz, we explore the world of postcards. Coconut postcards, to be exact. Perhaps you remember seeing those brightly painted and ready-to-mail coconuts at tourist stops, such as Mr. Pineapple in Kahului or an ABC store in Waikiki. But did you know that the Ho'olehua Post Office is the only place in the state where you can choose a blank coconut and decorate it to your own specifications? The Post-a-Nut program began in 1991, and the rural outpost on Molokai sent out over 3,000 of these uniquely missive annually to recipients throughout the U.S. mainland in countries such as Iceland, Namibia, and Easter Island. Now, customers choose from a pile of nuts that have passed ag inspection. They pay for the postage, which is determined by weight, and they utilize decorating materials provided by the post office and leave enough room to affix a colorful array of postage stamps and an agricultural inspection stamp. For today's quiz, can you tell us who created the Post-A-Nut program? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Chris Charbonneau from Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Next month marks the 180th birthday of Queen Liliuokalani. The Washington Place Foundation is marking the day with a birthday celebration at the home where the Queen once lived. Now, the celebration had to be suspended for several years while renovation on the second floor was underway. Now, construction is now complete, and the foundation is reestablishing the affair next month on September 8th. We sat down with Gussie Schubert, a descendant of John Dominus Holt, who built the home in the 1800s.
I am the great-great-granddaughter of Captain John Dominus and Mary Dominus, who built the home. They had a son, John Owen, who married Liliu. She could have no children of her own, but he had one through Mrs. Purdy, who's the mom, and he is Aimoku, who was hanaid by Liliu. He was one of three children hanaid by Liliu. He is my grandfather. He married Sybil McInerney and had lived with the queen for a long period of time. They had three children. All three children were born at Washington Place. The last one, the baby of the family, is my mom, Virginia Beatrice.
And so this connection, your personal connection with this home, I mean, that's marvelous.
Actually, it's the personal collection to her. It's the connection is to her and to things we received from the home or from them living there, not the actual home, because by the time I was born, it was already the governor's mansion. So my connection to the home itself, personally, it was more my mom than me.
Right, but do you have furniture pieces that were in that home? And there's that still that connection that you have with this history.
Oh, definitely. We have a two-seater sofa that is shown in pictures of 1910 to 1917. They were in the home. It was in our home, and I used to take naps on it. We also have some things like the umbrella stand. We have a koa table. We have oriental planters. We were lucky enough to get some of her jewelry, some of her letters, her letterhead. So, yes, we had quite a few pieces. But, you know, it's from my grandmother. It's not from the queen. But very definitely we enjoyed them and fortunately had a grandmother and a mother who took care of these items and taught us how to take care of them.
And so some of these things are on display at Washington Place or will be?
They are on since the renovation that was done last year that was open. That was a huge renovation for us, for the home. Actually, it was done, handled by DAGS. They take care of the building itself. The whole flooring was redone upstairs. Things were reinforced because, remember, this was built as a home, not as a museum. So, you know, a 100-and-some-odd-year-old home needs a bit of repair and loving attention. So we were finally able to open up the second floor, and we have personal items on the second floor from those who lived at the home, of which includes the Dominus family and Liliu herself. And we can have people up there with confidence now rather than worrying about the home itself.
Right, and safety, really, for the public that's coming through there.
Very definitely. Well, the foundation was formed in 1999, and let me tell you, these plans were started way back then, but you know that everything has to be done in stages. So this last renovation, we've actually had two renovations within the last 3 to 4 years. You know, the first one involved termite treatment to the home, taking care of the green lanai and all the columns that were outside that were deteriorating outside, the glass windows in the glass lanai that roll up and down, they were taken out and all reinforced because they were sagging, and a number of smaller issues that were taken care of. And then in the second phase, again, the major thing was the flooring upstairs. We had two columns inside of the home that had to be reinforced, two at the same time. Joists were reinforced, and then a flooring was put back down, and then the home was painted inside. Glenn Mason, of course, has worked with the home and with DAGS so that things are followed through correctly. The foundation is very lucky, and I think the home is very lucky that we have Cameron Heen as the executive director, because he was a definite overseer of all the things that were going on and watching out for different things and just being sure that things were being followed that the way they did. The contractor that they chosen was very careful, has worked on the home before. The painters were very careful. They've worked on the home before. So it's a home that draws you in, and you need to take care of it.
Right, and I know the property is also used for official functions, the back lanai.
First and foremost is the governor's events. They're the most important because it is the governor's home, the governor's mansion. They do signing of bills. They've done, pinning of people from the military. They do different departments have their events there sometimes too, but they also rent the home out for events from outside factors that you can have.
I remember going there around Christmas time. I think outside they had little things for the children. Whether it was decorating cookies or, just really nice events.
Mary Dominus was the first one to introduce the Christmas tree and Santa Claus in 1858. And so she had a party for 100 kids that would come to the home. They were greeted by Santa Claus, first time they've ever seen him. And then they went upstairs for her Christmas tree, and there was a gift under the tree for each child. After all the children received their gifts, and I'm not really sure what else was involved because the newspaper didn't say what it is, they were sent home and the parents had a good party.
Good fun. Now, this has been the home for the governors of Hawaii. Different times, different tastes. I imagine they brought in, their own things, and some had pets.
Yeah, very definitely. The home was lived in, which was wonderful because that's how a home stays alive. Each governor and his family brought their own taste to the homes. Mostly it was upstairs, which people didn't see because that was the private headquarters, their private area for them to have and to enjoy their family life. But they were definitely incorporated in a lot of things that were happening at the home. So it was Vicky Cayetano who started the foundation, who felt that the home should become a historic home or a museum. So the foundation was founded, and the home for the residence for the governor that's now built in the back was built for them. Second floor has never been open to the public. Even in the Queen's time when she was living there, it was definitely personal life up there. So what we're trying to show upstairs and hopefully be able to work with everyone is to show people glimpses into the different families that have lived there. We were able to work with the governor's families and their descendants for choosing pictures. We have a governor's parlor now that shows, we have a collage for each governor that shows nice. Different pictures that were chosen by the family so that were things that were important to them at that point in time. So it's nice to be able to work with them. Yes.
Right, a little slice of life in Hawaii history.
Yes.
And so you folks have a fundraiser coming up.
Yes, we have a fundraiser. It's our annual fundraiser that we have every year. It will be on September 8th, held at the home. It's music and dinner, and the dinner is being done by Ed Kenny. And we have music by Kimo Keolana and Le Hulu, his group. He's a trio that will be doing during pupu time. During dinner, we have the string quartet from the symphony. And then after dinner, we have been lucky enough to have Halau Ikaweku. The reason why these people are all chosen asked to be a part of the event is because either they are doing something for the Queen, in memory of the Queen, just trying to perpetuate what she offered to all of us in the islands.
And then you also have a couple other events in October, I believe.
Actually, at the end of September and end of October, we actually are having movie night at Washington Place. It will be showing of the documentary, Liliuokalani Reflections of Our Queen, that was written and produced by Edgy Lee. We will be serving a light dinner, and we'll have the home open for you to be able to walk through and to see the different things. And we will have the Queen's music will be sung. Nola Nahulu and her group, HYLC, will be singing. The Queen wanted the home to perpetuate Hawaiian language and music and the culture. So that is one of the things that we're trying to do, to be able to bring forward all of the things that are going on and just trying to incorporate what she wanted at the home.
Well, thank you for spending time with us and sharing the story.
Thank you.
That was Gussie Schubert, who's with the Washington Place Foundation, talking about the fundraising dinner and the film screenings that will take place next month at the historic home. For details on tickets, check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Oceanfront Beach Tree Restaurant at Four Seasons Resort Hualalai. Open daily for lunch and dinner, featuring Italian and Mediterranean cuisine with Californian and tropical influences using locally sourced ingredients.
It is now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Political and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us this morning, and today we're talking post-election and a story about ranked choice voting. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Catherine.
So explain to our listeners, what is ranked choice voting?
Right. It's also called instant runoff voting. It's something that does not exist in Hawaii, but they use it in Maine. They use it in some U.S. cities, particularly in California. Even the Academy Awards uses it big picture. Yeah, so that's really what's most important, right? But here's how it works. In a large field of candidates, which we had in several races this election, voters actually rank their preference, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, on down. If no candidate gets a majority, meaning 50% plus one, well, what happens is that lowest vote getter, they get knocked off, they get eliminated. But here's the tricky part. Even though some people voted that vote, lowest vote getter, as their first choice, that gets eliminated, and instead they take the second choice. They make that the first pick, and they recalculate. In other words, what you're getting here is you may have favored one candidate, but you might have gone for a second one, and a third one would have been okay, and if you had to live with the fourth one, you would have, and these numbers keep on getting calculated until finally somebody gets a majority of the votes and becomes the winner. Did that make sense?
Well, so it is kind of confusing. So is this a cheaper way to do the election or a more expensive way?
You know, I don't know that the dollar factor is factored in. There wouldn't be another vote. You simply vote that one time, and you rank them, and presumably the computers and the elections office takes care of the rest. But the idea is that you would get a better representative of the people's choice. And think about this example. You know how you had many candidates running both for lieutenant governor and also for the first congressional district, six people in one field, five in the other? Well, imagine this. Imagine if there had been a runoff between Ed Case and Doug Chin and Donna Kim for the congressional race, or between Josh Green and Jill Takuda and Bernard Carvalho in the lieutenant governor's race, or possibly even people who finished further on down the line, if voters were willing to choose that person as a second or third favorite choice. Instead, what you got was Ed Case getting in with 38% of the vote, 39%. And Josh Green got in with 30.2, barely beating Jill Takuda. The idea is it would be a fairer vote. It would represent really the majority's needs. And it would probably give other candidates a better chance of getting elected, particularly independent and third-party candidates.
So how long has this idea been kicked around?
It's been kicked around for a while. It's actually, as I said, being used in several places. I'll give you one other example just to anchor it here in Hawaii. Maybe we would only use it in special elections. Remember in 2010, Charles DeJoux got into Congress for a very short time, about 7 months. He had a special election to fill Neil Abercrombie's seat. But Ed Case and Colleen Hanabusa actually finished third and second. In other words, a majority of the voters actually wanted a Democrat in the race rather than the Republican. This would have been a fairer representation. By the way, as well, there has actually been legislation proposed at the legislature to consider this. It hasn't gone anywhere, but Common Cause Hawaii, among others, thinks it might not be a bad idea.
So what about for the smaller parties? How does that work
for
them?
Well, the idea is that you could get in if you're a Green Party or a Constitution Party or a Libertarian Party because in many ways the vote would be equalized. As you know, our Democratic primary in many ways is the only primary. There is a general election against the Republicans and a few third-party and nonpartisan candidates. But almost always we go with the Democrats and maybe a few Republicans. Very rarely does an independent or third-party candidate get elected to office, and the idea behind ranked choice or instant runoff voting is they would have a much better chance because it would be up to the voters to say, you know, maybe I'll give this Libertarian a chance. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll go with this Green. Instead, too many people want to go with who they think is going to win, right? And that tends to be the Democratic candidate in this state. There would also be no spoiler effect. There would be nobody like a Clayton He might have been a spoiler in the governor's race between Colleen Hanabusa and David Ige. He ended up dropping out, but you know, why would you vote for a spoiler? Why not actually vote for the people that you think are best and rank them in order of preference?
Right. Okay. All right. I can see where people are like, you know what? I'm not going to rank these people. I'm just going to vote for one, and then just I can see that happening too.
I think that's the case too. But look at the OHA races. There's another example where many more people just left votes blank. They may have picked one when you could pick three. Is that really the best system in terms of getting the majority's preference into office? Arguably not.
Right. Okay. All right. Thanks, Chad.
Thank you.
That was Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read the full story and more, visit civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with Christopher Phillips and Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can look for in our dark skies. We're grateful to be welcoming back Christopher Phillips. He's got the information for us, and we've got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Jupiter in the west after sunset. Also, Mars can be seen toward the south, along with Saturn as well. The moon this week will be full, meaning spotting those faint objects in the heavens is going to be very tricky indeed.
This week you've got something about researchers studying a black hole at the center of the galaxy?
Yes, astronomers using the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, or JCMT, atop Mauna Kea, have been studying the center of the Milky Way galaxy in order to understand the monstrous black hole lurking at its center. This supermassive black hole is known as Sagittarius A, and its feeding habits have become quite the subject of interest for Hawaii astronomers.
And when you talk about feeding habits, you're not talking about fruits and vegetables. It's eating something pretty serious, right?
Right. Sagittarius A consumes vast quantities of gas and dust that collects around its gaping celestial maw in what we call a circumnuclear disk. This is basically a ring of material that's caught in the gravitational grip of the black hole.
And if the stuff is circling the black hole, explain how it gets consumed.
The black hole exists in an environment of powerful magnetic fields that cause material to be driven inward and consumed. In some ways, they are like our arms and hands, which we use to pick up food and put into our mouths. For the black hole, they perform essentially the same function, directing matter along those lines and into its cavernous maw, never to be seen again.
So are you saying astronomers could see this stuff flowing into the black hole? Is that what gave it away?
Exactly. Using JCMT's large 15-meter dish and sub-millimeter instruments, they were able to see Sagittarius A feasting on the remains of dead stars and worlds.
Another exciting report and a local connection here. Christopher Phillips, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And Stargazers on demand at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary. Architects for the offices of the Liliuokalani Trust, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
Today, we told you about the unique Post-A-Nut program that made Molokai's Holehua Post Office a visitor go-to destination since 1991. This is where you can choose and decorate your own coconut postcard. Now, there's no charge for the coconut. Customers only have to pay for the postage, ranging from $12 to $20, and the price is determined by weight. Sharpies and other decorating materials are on hand, but staff will often remind all budding Picassos to leave enough room to affix the required agricultural inspection and postage stamps. Now, according to Postmaster Gary Lamb, the Post-A-Nut program was created by his predecessor, Margaret Keahi Leary, over a quarter century ago because she wanted to provide a way for residents and visitors to send an unusual, authentic bit of Molokai to their friends. Now, we had no winners. We stumped you on that bit of trivia. But that's today's quiz, and if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@HawaiiPublicRadio.org. In the surf world, hydrofoil boards are turning heads. In the south of France, the town of Anglet has actually taken steps to ban hydrofoils altogether. It's believed to be the first such ban in the Atlantic. Here in the Pacific, Hawaii organizers of the stand-up paddle race between Molokai and Oahu added a hydrofoil division, also a first. The winner, all-round waterman Kai Lenny, made the trek in under 3 hours. We talked with him after his win about the growing pains of this new sport, which he calls misunderstood.
Well, the amazing thing about the hydrofoil is it just opens up a whole nother realm to enjoy the ocean and surfing. Surfing is really one of the most fun and difficult sports in the world to do, but you're limited to how good the waves are and where you live at most times. Whereas the foil, be it a lake, a river, an ocean, a sea, just about anywhere you could have fun with one of those, and you don't need good conditions. If anything, you need bad conditions because those are almost when the hydrofoil flourishes. So it's almost like we're scoring conditions that nobody else wants.
I just noticed that there's an article online that talks about this town in southern France that is trying to ban hydrofoiling. So why is that?
I think it's because basically, when you don't understand something, people tend to jump to conclusions. I know that anything new, for whatever reason in human nature, it seems that people aren't accustomed to want to change. And something so new like this, I think they see this big fin or the hydrofoil underneath the board and see it as being extremely dangerous, which on the contrary is actually probably more safe than a traditional surfboard fin, only because the leading edge of the hydrofoil is much more dull. And if you were to hit somebody, sure, it might hurt, but just like any board, it would hurt. But unlike a surf fin, it's not like a surf fin is extremely sharp. So there's like, I think it's a common misunderstanding, and it's a lot of fear based on just, you know, just about everything, you know, jumping to conclusions. They've never had any problems there from what I can tell. And they also have, you know, very little people that even do it. So I think they're just kind of looking out for the people around, or a lot of times this sort of thing, I think, happens because people that don't agree on a new sport or a new wave riding waves, they usually just want to like, well, if I don't like it, everyone can't do it. And I think that's sort of like, that's why it's happening. And maybe a couple other towns will do the same, but so far, you know, here in Hawaii, we haven't had any problems with it. I think the number one rule is with a hydrofoil is there's no reason to go into a crowded lineup where people traditional surf, because, you know, the best waves for foiling are really almost unsurfable.
Well, that's the thing I wanted to bring up, actually, because we often hear about conflicts, you know, in the lineup. I mean, we heard that with windsurfing and kite surfing and paddleboarding. What makes this different?
I think what makes it different is that surfing is kind of a tribal sport to begin with. One, because there's not a whole lot of waves to go around, and being the most free, liberating sport there is, there's kind of a lot of greed to wanting to get as many waves as you can, which is understandable. It's the funnest sport in the world to do, so you can imagine people want to get the most out of it. So when another sport comes in and threatens to take away waves that, you know, people believe is theirs, that's where I think the conflict sort of begins. And it's also, too, when you have certain sports that come along that give you the ability to take more of an advantage than surfing. So people that in the wrong hands, people take advantage of it and hog waves, which I think everyone should be able to wait their turn, and, you know, everyone should have a fair chance at catching waves. But, you know, that's just not how it always works out. But what makes foil so different and getting to the point is that it gives you the ability to go places nobody else can go or would want to go. You know, if a surfer wanted to follow you to the best foil wave, they wouldn't even be able to ride a wave because it requires a foil to allow you to ride the swell. And in my opinion, that's the best part of foiling, is those type of conditions. So, you know, I think there's going to be a conflict with those who maybe use a hydrofoil and hog waves, or people feel unsafe around them. And it's not the sport's fault so much as it is the individual. I think we tend to blame the sports versus the individuals when, you know, we should all take responsibility for our own actions in and out of the water.
Now, when I look at video clips of someone riding a hydrofoil, it just looks like a lot of work because you're pumping, really. I mean, it's like when the lifeguard I was talking to said, oh, yeah, there was a guy that rode away for like a half mile. I'm like, whoa, that's a lot of work. Are you more tired when you come off of a hydrofoil than another board?
No, I think that surfing is more fatiguing than actually riding a hydrofoil. The pumping part, there's no resistance. You know, you're free of surface tension, so you're not dragging a board through the water or skimming a board through the water. The foil itself is always creating lift. So every time you pump, which most of the time when you're pumping is usually on the, you know, when you're not on a wave and you're trying to pump to another wave, or if you need a little bit of speed to get to the next section, it really is, it would be like similar to how it would feel running versus spinning on a bicycle. When you spin on a bicycle, your legs are moving, but you can do it in such a way on such a gear that it takes minimum to zero effort. So I would say the hydrofoil is almost easier once you're doing it. You know, it's hard to learn, but once you're doing it, it feels really easy on the body, honestly, really easy on the joints, as if you had suspension on a surfboard. You know, you don't feel any chop or any of that stuff. It's actually quite peaceful.
As I look at some of these video clips online, it's really like about balance. I mean, you talk about like being on a snowboard versus, let's say, a windsurfer, you know, where maybe you're tipping back versus leaning forward. I mean, it just seems like really tricky as you jump from one kind of board to the next.
I mean, yeah, you know, it can be pretty difficult to go from one board to the next because it takes a little bit of an adjustment, but it's amazing what the human body is capable of adapting to subconsciously without you even having to think about it. And I'm one that's able to do all these sports so frequently that my body's gotten used to switching between and not you know, needing to take as much time to adjust. But the foil, you know, at first glance, it looks like it would be really tricky to stand on, because all you, in your mind, you just see this sort of, you know, mast or fin coming out of the water, and it looks like that's your balance point. But the board itself is your platform, so it really does feel like you're maybe standing on a skateboard. And depending on the foil you have underwater, those wings, which is essentially an underwater airplane, has so much stability, both vertically or like forward, side to side, almost all accesses. So to be honest, it's almost more stable once you are in the air than a normal surfboard would be. And a lot of times people fall because they're not used to something so stable. It's like so stable that their normal reactions on a normal board, where you can feel the rail dip into the ocean and you can feel the board start to turn that way, it's a little bit different dynamic. You have to almost push a little bit harder to make it move. It's really just a different technique altogether. But yeah, you know, it's incredibly stable, and that's why we're able to do it inter-island, being able to go from one island to the next without ever coming off a foil and riding multiple waves for, you know, as long as you're physically able to do it. I mean, if you really had to, doing 100 miles wouldn't be that hard compared to, let's say, another sport that would be more physically taxing. The stand-up paddle event was incredible. Molokai to Oahu, it's an annual race that's been going on for 22 years. And since I was a little kid, I did it on prone paddle boards as well as stand-up paddle boards as well. And this was the first year that they allowed hydrofoils to be in the event in their own division. And what was insane about it was that it was just so happened to be on a really good windy year, which is ideal for the foil in the ocean, because the windier it is, the bigger the swells, and the bigger the swells, the faster you go on a hydrofoil. So it gave us that did it for the first time the opportunity to kind of showcase the sport with an official time. And the time was really pretty record-breaking, being able to break that three-hour sort of mark. I was able to do the whole crossing in 2:52. And it's not that the sport's better than any other sports. In fact, these other sports are incredible, and I give them so much props for being at times even harder to do. But what's amazing about the hydrofoil is you're able to cross an entire ocean with a board that is, you know, vertically the same size as you, and you're able to go faster than any craft without a sail or a motor. So I think what evolution has taught us is that, you know, when things sort of evolve, they're always like, things are never going to stop doing that. And with the foil, we're only scratching the surface with what is possible in the ocean. It's just sort of opened up a whole new realm for people to enjoy it.
How many people were out there when you competed?
Well, in the hydrofoil division, we had 10 people, and the one female athlete, Annie Reichart, she is 17 years old, and she did absolutely amazing and was the first girl to cross any of the channels on the hydrofoil in Hawaii.
Well, I know when you were young, a lot of people were like, whoa, Kai Lenny, you know, how old are you now?
I'm 25.
25. Do you feel like an old man?
You know what? I don't. I feel pretty young, and I feel like I'm not even in my prime yet. So it's pretty exciting. Although, you know, there's a lot of really young kids coming up now that are 14, 15, 16 years old that, you know, by the time they're my age are going to be absolutely incredible and, you know, pushing the sport even farther and farther. And my goal is to keep on hopefully being on the cutting edge of it all with them. It's pretty exciting.
So when you get on a hydrofoil, I mean, do you have bragging rights? Like, okay, can you surf faster than me? You know?
I think the bragging rights for me is mostly just among my friends that I race with personally on, you know, any given day at home. The whole idea of just trying to go as fast as you can is so fun. And like, since the sport is so technical, the way that you have to read the ocean, the way you have to read the bumps is it's like reading a chessboard really well. If you make all the right moves, you're going to win and you're going to come out ahead. But if you make mistakes, like don't read the ocean really good, it's funny because like, if you've never done any downwinders and you just started going on a hydrofoil, you'll be faster than most of the crafts in the water. But it does take years, I think, of knowledge and experience of doing those downwinders on these other crafts that allowed me to be able to go as fast as I go downwind. And the exciting thing is like, speed is just something that I absolutely love. And the reason why is mainly because of the exhilaration. And I've never had to be so focused in my life for so long. To compare it to like normal surfing, I feel like I'm surfing a big wave when I'm out in the open ocean riding swells on the hydrofoil. It's like takes all my focus, and maybe not as physically taxing as riding a paddleboard or a stand-up paddleboard or a canoe, but maybe more mentally taxing because of the focus it requires.
More mentally taxing than tow and surf?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, because you're you know, tow and surfing, if you ride a 50-foot wave, the longest ride most of the time you're going to get is 30 seconds because a wave that big going that fast is going to, you know, implode on the reef really quick. Whereas when you're out in the middle of the ocean, you know, you have Molokai and Oahu 32 miles apart. That's going to take a while to, you know, you're going to have plenty. You're going to have plenty of time to try to, like, Your body's going to be wanting to lose focus the whole time, because how do you stay so focused on, like, basically a little dot moving in the ocean for, you know, a couple of hours? It's one of those sports where you'll be able to surf the biggest wave in the world if you wanted. You could surf the smallest wave in the world, and you can also surf in the middle of the ocean. I don't see, with the hydrofoil, I don't see there having to be a problem with fighting over waves, considering you really don't need to ride with anybody ever, just because the worst wave is still the best wave. I mean, that's what I love about it is, you know, you can go surf Crowded Pipeline and get the wave of your life, but you could also go get the wave of your life at a wave that, you know, doesn't even break.
It doesn't even break. That was Maui resident Kai Lenny sharing his story about riding a hydrofoil during the Molokai to Oahu Channel crossing.
On the media, a look at a platform where real-life victories and defeats unfold in real time and rack up more views than HBO and Netflix.
As you guys know, I have a beautiful family and a wife and kid, and I want to be transparent that I've been unfaithful.
Why so many of us can't look away. On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This evening at 7.
We have to go, but up tomorrow we talk about a new cap on film credits statewide and what that might mean. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talk back line. Leave your comments. What do you think of our film industry? Here's a number, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you miss any of this show, just check out our conversation page with links to information and guests. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.